Anyway, I'll introduce myself because I don't trust David to.
As you will.
Anyway, thank you for David to dragging me up here to San Diego to try to convince, you know, multi-year project to convince me to work on neuroscience, and it's been very interesting and very learning experience. So I'm going to talk about some work that's been ongoing for the last couple of years with Terry Sanowski, and of course, as is always the case in these, most of the work was done by a couple of postdocs, Suhita Nadkarni and Vladislav Ullman, who are both sort of in some random admixture of UCSD Physics Department and the Salk Institute. And first I'll give you a little bit of motivation, probably unnecessary given all the other talks we've had, but you know, why not? And then I'll talk about sort of two projects that are coupled to each other loosely. One project is to look at more detailed biophysical models of presynaptic calcium dynamics at the synapse to try to understand better what are some of the underlying mechanisms on the biophysical level having to do with plasticity and, you know, facilitation, depression, etc. And then I will shift to trying to ask, okay, so what? So what, you know, what good does it do to the nervous system or circuits in the neural system to have more complicated dynamics of the synapse? Can one make progress on that question? And we'll see if I do or not. That's a good question. Okay. So motivation. Well, I said well, given the talks over the last 2 weeks, I don't need to put this up, but you know, I spent many years listening to physicists talk about, mostly theorists, talking about models of the nervous system. Of course, that started back in McCullough and Pitts with very simple threshold rate models. And you know, eventually people get to Hopfield models, integrated fire models, or whatever. You know, they're conductance-based models, but even those are usually zero-dimensional. And there's a whole literature and, you know, progress and lots of work and lots of excitement. And of course, then coming at it from my perspective, which is someone who spends most of their time looking at much simpler cells, usually microorganisms, you look at those models and you say, how can this possibly be right given the complexities of real neurons? And real complexities, we've heard about them repeatedly in the last week and a half, and you know them better than I do, so there's no reason to belabor the issues. And so the bottom line message from my perspective is that simple cells do rather sophisticated calculations to determine when to divide, where to go, what genes to express. Why would we expect neurons to be doing less sophisticated calculations given that they're much more complex in terms of their morphology, capabilities, dynamical components, et cetera, et cetera. Now, when I told this to Fred and he didn't believe me at some point, he said, well, how do you know that's true? Maybe, you know, they're just specialized and it really is all in the connections. And so I don't have an answer to that, but I just wanted to point out some papers or series of papers that actually have been influential in my thinking, not so much in what we actually do. There's a series of papers by Seth Grant looking at a sort of informatic analysis of the evolution of the nervous system. And there's a long story here, and I, you know, for those of you interested in this, it's certainly worth reading these papers. But essentially the message is that complexity measured in terms, initially in this paper, in terms of the number of components, on the postsynaptic density, where those components came from in terms of other homologs in yeast, other homologs in Drosophila, those things sort of march in increased complexity and sort of step with increasing complexity in the number of neurons, the number of connections, the number of different specialized areas of the brain. So you should not think, if you believe works like this, that the brain starts out at, let's say, Drosophila with a set of components which are more or less fixed, and then what happens is you just increase the number of neurons and the number of their connections. In fact, every stage along the way, things become more capable and more sophisticated. And that goes all the way down, not only to the cell level, but also to the individual protein level. And so, for example, just one figure from their paper is you can compare what the NMDA receptor looks like in Drosophila versus mouse, and you see that it's been highly elaborated. The NMDA receptor in mouse, and of course in us, becomes a scaffold for a whole assembly of proteins that obviously must be doing something much more sophisticated than simple NMDA receptor as it originally evolved back, you know, whenever. Okay, so this is just, again, motivation for saying that there must be some use not only in having a large number of connections, but also in having the underlying components have extra interesting, important degrees of freedom. Okay. So given that sort of basic motivation, what we've been trying to do in this collaboration over the last couple of years is use, you know, basically, you know, yes,
David? Experimental question. Was there ever a system in which genetically you sort of de-evolved a receptor?
You mean when someone has replaced the NMDA receptor gene with an equivalent one from Drosophila and asked what is the behavioral phenotype?
Right.
That's a very good question. I don't know if that can be done in mouse, maybe. I don't know. Someone else should answer that question, not me. I haven't seen such a paper, but...
People modify receptors if there is, you know, ways. Cut down.
Well, you could, I mean, if this were a microorganism, you know, you could easily knock out completely the NMDA receptor and plug in a different one. Now, how easy that is to do in a mouse, and does the mouse survive, and all these other questions, I just don't have, I've never seen that. So maybe that type, maybe papers by Grant and others will lead people to think about those questions, but I've never seen it, so... But, you know, okay. Okay, so given this general framework of thinking, what we've been doing is, first of all, trying to devise, you know, better biophysical models to think about neural components. I'll mostly talk about work on the synapse, the presynaptic side of the synapse. These models, of course, you know, are models and compare to experiments in their own right, in the sense that there is a large amount of data, many labs that work just on synaptic physiology, and that provides, you know, calibration and predictions for the model. So you can treat that just as any other problem in sort of cell biology, where the cells just happen to be neurons and you happen to be looking at one particular set of issues. But then, of course, what's more interesting is to use those models and those insights to try to figure out what the implications might be for neuronal dynamics, and that's the harder part. And okay, and then there's the disclaimer, which is I'm very much in the steep part of the learning curve, and that will probably be obvious as I go along. Okay. So as I told Chuck, you know, it's really strange for me to be getting up here and introducing people to synaptic dynamics, given, you know, my background and the background of other people in the room, but nonetheless, here goes. So the way the presynaptic terminal works is, of course, that there are vesicles. Those vesicles are located, you know, in sort of a releasable pool that creates something called an active zone. So it's a sort of defined region of the presynaptic membrane where the vesicles are sort of docked and sort of ready to go in some sense. And ready to go requires, of course, a signal to come in to release the vesicles. That signal is calcium mediated. It's created by depolarizing the presynaptic membrane. That depolarization leads to influx of calcium through voltage-dependent calcium channels. Those calcium ions, so that's here. Where's, there must be a pointer, a laser pointer somewhere.
Here.
Well, I can use the analog one. Either one.
Well, there's an optics meeting going on, so
In honor of the optics one, I should use the other one, okay. So calcium comes in through these voltage-gated channels, and the calcium binds to a particular set of proteins located on the vesicles, which you can think of as a sensor, a calcium sensor. And when enough calcium is detected, I'll talk a little bit about the state of the art of models of that calcium sensor due to Sudoff's group in a moment. When it binds, then it initiates some rather interesting biophysical change, you know, changing the topology of the membrane, which again is an interesting problem in its own right. I won't talk about that at all, which then leads to release of the vesicle. Now, of course, as you release vesicles, you might run out of them at the active zone. And so on a longer time scale, there are mechanisms which replenish the vesicles on the active zone. But one of the things that you need to take into account is that if you fire too rapidly, you can lead to synaptic depression, which can be just due to running out of vesicles to release if you fire too rapidly. And that's going to be one of the issues that we discuss. Now, this is sort of a unit system, a sort of active zone. Different synapses have very different numbers of active zones. We heard about the calyx of Held, which is a very specialized synapse having to do with the auditory system, where very precise release and very precise timing information has to go from the nerve cell to the next cell down in the network. And it the sort of evolution doesn't take any chances there, and you have hundreds of these active zones producing a system that's massively redundant, massively parallel, and essentially fluctuationless. So, you know, a signal comes in, and it just creates a deterministic release, and very accurate timing. On the other hand, the synapses we're going to be talking about, which are CA3 to CA1 excitatory synapses, the number of active zones is small, you know, 1 to 5 may be a typical number. So here, one of the issues is going to be that this process, especially the dynamics of calcium coming in through voltage-gated sensors, calcium diffusing, calcium binding to the synaptic release sensor, all those things can be stochastic. And if you don't have 100 of them in parallel, then of course you expect to see large fluctuations. Yes?
So I just want to miss that. So I want to ask this of you, Chuck, the same day I asked it of you, Keith Goda, and I got different answers at the same time. So how many vesicles get released per action potential, per calcium influx?
Well,
it's one of these things that
it bears on these numbers.
Yes.
So the first thing is that it's really rare for a hippocampal synapse to have more than one active zone. I've never seen one with 5. I mean, there are billions of them, but it's a very rare thing. And the second thing is there's a dispute with one action potential coming, many vesicles can be released, but within a very brief period of time, within say 10 milliseconds, there are people who believe there can be only one, and there's some mechanism to ensure that there's not more than one, and other people believe that's not true.
So one issue is that one of these active zones, we're going to assume that the overall release probability is actually like 20-30%. So the probability, just in terms of that, of having more than one released is very small. Okay. Then Chuck pointed out a second issue, which, you know, we've had many discussions on, which is the fact that there seems to be some biophysical mechanism that prevents two vesicles from being released simultaneously. Well, simultaneously here means within 5 to 10 milliseconds of each other. That's a separate mechanism. So that means that even beyond the overall probability, actually releasing the second one is even less likely, because after 10 milliseconds has gone by, the calcium signal has gone down, so your chance of releasing the second one is lower than you would have guessed. There's sort of an extra inhibition there. So by the time it was all said and done, the chances of releasing more than one are probably really small. That's my understanding.
Since we read it, I was always wondering, what is the peak concentration of, say, glutamate during synaptic transmission? I always hear 1 millimole for 1 millisecond.
In the cleft? I don't remember
where
that.
Where does this come from, this number? It has diffused into my brain.
Well, it's not exactly constant in the cleft. Yeah. It's going to diffuse.
Peak concentration is 1 millimole for 1 millisecond. Is this true, or is this?
I just don't remember what the.
The simulations are the best way of knowing.
Yeah, and I just
measure it. Right, and so he's going to give simulations.
But I'm not going to talk about the glutamate diffusion. We're just assuming that's simple, so I'm not going to worry about.
Are there Frommer's or Rogers glue sniffer we never put in the cleft?
There's a paper by Gary Westbrook on inhibition that has data that somehow gets it back.
I mean, there are calculations which basically take some amount of glutamate in a vesicle and then just have it, have it be released and see how far it diffuses before it's sort of pumped back in by active transporters. And, you know, that's other work done by Tom Bartol and people like that, but I don't remember the numbers offhand.
But also, it's hard to calculate because it binds to a lot of things in there. So it's kind of buffered.
Anyway, if you come across a paper which sort of addresses
it, but you couldn't believe it because you can't measure.
Well, one of the reasons that there can be only one vesicle releasing
could be that energetically you need quite some energy to fuse the membrane and to open up the
Oh, absolutely. That could easily, yeah.
I mean, the snare complex needs energy. So that might be the reason why you cannot.
Right, but you might say, why don't different snare complexes and different vesicles act more or less independently? And the answer is, there could easily be that when one of them is trying to deform the membrane, it somehow mechanically prevents the other one from deforming the membrane the same time or something like that. I mean, I've not seen any even attempt at answering this question from a real, you know, fusion model or fusion. I mean, I haven't seen that either. I don't know.
There's no way to do it.
No way to do it.
How many vesicles roughly ballpark in CA3, CA1 active zone?
I think the number we use, this readily releasable, was 5 or so, 5 to 7 or something like that. Is that a typical number, or something like that?
The active zones have a wide range of sizes, and so there's a wide range of dot vesicles per active zone. But on the average, it's about half a dozen.
Yeah, that's the number we tend to.
Do you know how many potential fusion sites there are in a zone?
Well, what's the difference between a potential fusion site and a active zone docked vesicle? I'm not sure what. Well, okay, so I don't necessarily distinguish between the number of vesicles and the number of, we just think of there being like 5 docked vesicles, you know, at places where it could release. Now maybe there's a second step of vesicles are sitting up here and then they have to come specifically to this spot to dock. I don't know. I mean, I don't know what's the thinking on that.
It's believed that they can only dock at the active zone.
Oh, no, sure. But the question is it only that they can only dock at one place here and the others have to shuttle along here to get to that one spot? They can dock anywhere along this sort of active zone?
They can dock they can dock at multiple places in the active zone and can release at multiple places.
Yeah.
But only one seems to win and release.
There's what I consider compelling evidence for that, but not everyone agrees.
Yeah. Okay, now since I'm going to be spending, the next slide I feel better about, because the next slide I actually, you know, feel like I understand that this one has all sorts of complicated details. But the underlying message is that the dynamics of vesicle release is tied up with the dynamics of calcium inside this particular presynaptic zone. And so I wanted to just spend a minute telling you about calcium dynamics in general. This is sort of how I got into this subject. In a sense, was thinking about calcium dynamics in other cells, like cardiac cells or Xenopus oocytes, which is a good model system for calcium dynamics. And so calcium dynamics in general is a very interesting sort of spatial, nonlinear, dynamical, stochastic process. And here is just a cartoon of what it looks like in general. And of course, in any specific region, you might have some or all of these things. So essentially, calcium comes in, let's say through channels or maybe through some other ways. And it diffuses, it binds to various things, it certainly is buffered by large numbers of buffering molecules. And very often what can happen is you can have locally calcium amplifier elements. So the typical calcium amplifier element in a regular cell is the endoplasmic reticulum, and the way that works is you have receptors, the IP3 receptor and the reanidine receptor are the most common, that sit on the boundary, on the surface separating the endoplasmic reticulum from the rest of the cell. In the cytoplasm proper, the calcium concentration is very low. Inside the endoplasmic reticulum, it's maybe 100 times larger. Normally, though, it only leaks out very, very slowly. But on the other hand, if you open these channels, then you can get a large flux come out. And of course, what's interesting is that as calcium comes in from the external world, it is part of the trigger that leads to the opening of these channels. So you have what biologists have called calcium-induced calcium release. If calcium comes in, binds to one of these channels, reanidine just needs calcium by itself. IP3 receptors needs both calcium and this intracellular second messenger IP3, and then you can actually get amplification of the calcium signal. But even without amplification of the calcium signal, you still have calcium channels, calcium diffusion, calcium buffering, and then detection of calcium by whatever is being sensitive to it in the cell. Okay. back to sin. So that's just background material, as you know, just for calcium dynamics in general. Now, so the idea that synapses have extra degrees of freedom, and you might want to incorporate that in thinking about neural models, is certainly not a new idea. And of course, probably from my perspective, one of the most influential papers on trying to figure out how to do that in a relatively simple way goes back to Tzadok and Markram and with several other people. And David this afternoon is going to provide a much more detailed explanation of deriving this model and how it works in analytic cases. So let me just very briefly describe how this works. You have instead of having just a simple, alpha function or something which tells you what the postsynaptic current is following a spike, you actually have to solve a pair of auxiliary equations for X, which is sort of the available resources to release, and Y is the actual thing that then governs what is detected on the other side, the postsynaptic current. And essentially, every time you have a spike come by, you of course increase, you release something, but the amount you release is not a constant. It depends on the time evolution, depending on how previously you've released before. So the idea is that there's a time scale here, which is a recovery time scale, which let's say a typical value might be 800 milliseconds, and that if you release once every 800 milliseconds, then the vesicles have time to replenish and everything is fine. If you don't, then you suffer from resource limitations, and your amount of, on average, your amount of postsynaptic current generated by the presynaptic spike is going to be less. So this is presynaptic depression. Here is just an example of taking some model like this and just seeing what it does. So if you put in some presynaptic spike train that just was picked from some random place, then you can filter it through this synapse just by taking this delta functions. And what you can see is that when the spikes come too close to each other, you actually get depression of the postsynaptic current, or as generated by this model. Yes?
Is the recovery measured from complete depletion of vesicles?
So it's defined by this equation. So in other words, when you get spikes, it doesn't just deplete immediately. This is sort of an averaged model, having sort of many active zones and just counting the number of things. So the idea is that some will be depleted, some won't be depleted. And on average, you'll get you won't go down to zero. Of course, if you can drive X all the way down to zero if you really send in 500 hertz or something for 5 minutes. But this is just the recovery from whatever you are back to full capability.
Okay, and then relating it back to the model where you have, say, six vesicles.
Yeah, so.
And you fire, you have six actions.
Yeah, so this doesn't, so this is a much more averaged model. This assumes you have many active zones that are sort of being excited in parallel, and you're never going to run out completely. And so it converts a digital problem into an analog formula by averaging in some sense. And I think David was going to talk about that this afternoon. So I think we can save that for seeing how they really sort of derive this model this afternoon. Anyway, my next transparency is going to be why this is very often not good enough. So don't have to worry tremendously about this. But you do see that you do get consequences. Now, this is only synaptic depression. There's the inverse effect of synaptic facilitation, and that's usually attributed to the fact that calcium can stick around for some amount of time after it's initially brought into the cell by the presynaptic firing. So the logic is that you fire, you bring calcium into the cell, it either does or doesn't release a vesicle, then another spike comes in more quickly than the clearance of the calcium from the system, and now the threshold for the second firing can be lower than the threshold for the first firing. And similarly, if you go through, you can reach a new steady state. If you go through some rhythmic firing, you can reach a state where the effective resting level of the calcium has been raised by having that spike train, and then that makes it easier to reach the threshold for release release of a new one. So again, you can do this within the Sadox-Markov model, and they do this by having essentially this parameter U, which is a resource utilization parameter, essentially what's the probability of release, in a sense, actually increase after each use. And I think David will also discuss that in his talk this afternoon. So within the Sadox-Markov framework, you can have synaptic depression, and you can have synaptic facilitation, but there are some problems. And the problem is, well, of course, you know, there are problems with all models, that they're not accurate enough. But from our point of view, there are a couple problems here. First of all, as I was already said, this is a sort of deterministic averaged view of what's going on, as opposed to sort of a stochastic view based on having a finite number of vesicles and a probability of release. And you know, that may be important for CA3, CA1 synapses with, you know, one or a few active zones. There's no stochasticity in this model, but we know that release can occur spontaneously and also asynchronously. I'll define what asynchronous release is in a minute, but it basically means sort of delayed release compared to the original action potential. So none of that's sort of incorporated in this model. And also, in terms of the facilitation, if you really want to begin to sort of understand how various things can modulate facilitation by, for example, changing the calcium handling system in the presynaptic zone, you know, you'd like to have something that had more biophysical components there, so you'd have a chance of really making predictions. So, okay. So anyway, so given, you know, that this model is useful but somewhat limited in terms of some of the things we want to use, there's sort of two ways to proceed. One way is to scrap it and go back to a detailed biophysical model of what happens at the presynaptic zone. That's great, but the problem, of course, is that if you want to then use this as a building block for discussing circuits, you're not going to be able to solve a PDE for a synapse in each synapse of an interesting circuit. So this is useful to get a sort of grounding in what's real and try to see if you understand what's going on. But eventually, another approach, which is probably more useful from a systems perspective, is to try to just use this general idea, perhaps with some additional modifications and extensions that incorporate some additional effects that might be important. So this is, you know, when you come to a fork in the road, so we take it. In other words, we actually go both ways. And the first half of what I'll describe will be sort of the first way down this fork, and the second thing will be sort of the second way down that fork. Okay.
So you can describe what you can describe both of these.
Yeah. I'm going to start with this, and then I'm going to discuss that. Okay.
Oh, God.
Well, it's worse. Well, okay. Well, you know.
You can say anything at this point, and we'll believe you.
Well, I didn't show you the movie. I mean, what did Tom tell me? They hired this company that does rendering for some Hollywood studio to make movies based on their simulations. It seemed completely strange to do that, but nonetheless, I guess. Anyway, so a presynaptic model. So what are we actually going to do? We're going to create a, you know, one person's very realistic model is another person's totally phenomenological model. You have to decide what is important, what's not. We're going to create a sort of cell scale model of what's going on, where first of all we have a spatial box, so calcium will diffuse in that box. So the geometry of what's going on, in particular, the separation between where the calcium enters and where it's sensed by the snare machinery is going to be important. And calcium also can get buffered, so that's these sort of large molecules over here that can swallow calcium and effectively reduce their ability to diffuse. That's a well-known feature of calcium dynamics in cells. And here is our, you know, the pictorial rendering of the machinery for release. And this, which I'll show you a better on the next, is a pictorial rendering of the model gotten from Tom Sudoff of how release actually works. So just to sit, you know, just to tell you what's going to be in the model, we use Sudoff's release model. We have a box modeling an en passant, a bouton, and an axon. Yes?
But I mean, the box is only relevant if the diffusion constant is such that you don't sense the walls of the box. And because of the buffering,
The box is not tremendously relevant.
The box is irrelevant, perhaps, because of the effect of the
diffusion constant. Yeah, because calcium tends to get Yeah, it's like by the time you take into account the fact that it's pumped back out and buffered, the box is basically irrelevant, but you've got to put it in a box.
It has holes in the end.
Yeah, yes.
At the box,
yeah, it's reflective boundaries. But of course, you shouldn't do that. You should really, I mean, it's probably the sides are reflective, and, you know, then you have this thing attached to the axon at some level, but we don't model that in any way. But David says, yeah, I mean, you know, so for example, you know, it would make no sense at all from my perspective to try to take an EM picture of an exact spatial structure of a bouton and put it in here, because to the extent that that's making a difference, you don't, you know, it wouldn't matter.
Are you aware of how many calcium ions are there?
Oh, gee, I should remember. A large number. So we can try to work it out based on the concentrations, which are sort of micromolar with this size. I could probably think about it. But so one of the things I'm going to tell you is that although we do explicit particle tracking, noise due to calcium diffusion is really not that important. You could also solve a PDE. Okay. As opposed to noise doing to random opening and closings of channels, which are important. Okay, so there is stochasticity here, but not due to having too few calcium ions. Okay, we also separately did the same calculations with the PDE, and you can get the same answers. So that's not a... Well, that's why we did it, because we wanted to ask, many people in the physics community have been spending their lives devising these programs like MCell, which is the one we use here from Tom Bartol, of individual particle tracking under the argument that, well, stochasticity is very important. And the answer is, well, there are some times when stochasticity due to particle numbers is very important. But there are other times when, you know, we shouldn't have to go backwards, and, you know, the derivations of PDEs from, you know, 100 years ago in physics are still fine. So this falls into the second case. You could use a PDE model, and so we check that, and it doesn't change the answers. Now, which is more computational efficient is another argument. I mean, the argument of the people who do MCell is always, well, you know, having a particle tracking model allows you to put in realistic geometries and other things. Of course, then we do it in a box. So, and I would argue that's fine, that we should do it in a box. So therefore, the argument about realistic geometries is a red herring. But nonetheless, it works fine, and the results are accurate, and so we just use it.
Why is the box much longer in one direction than in the other?
Oh, that's just what, you know, some idealized version of what an n-Poisson bouton might look like. It's not, you know. Okay. So let me talk about this. So most of the work on the details of the calcium sensor and its relationship to release have been done, obviously, in the calyx of hell, because you have a much easier system to make measurements on. And essentially, large numbers of groups have been doing that. We took some model that essentially is due to Sudoff's group. And forget about that. I mean, this is one of these incredibly complicated looking Markov chains of all the different states of the sensor. But there are sort of only a couple of takeaway lessons that are important for what I want to talk about here. So first of all, there's this type of sensor model has two release modes, a release mode called synchronous release and a release mode called asynchronous release. So synchronous release requires binding, if you just count going from here to here to here to here, requires binding of 5 calcium. So it actually has a very sharp turn on in terms of the Hill coefficient, however you want to think about it, and requires a pretty large calcium to do it. But if you have that larger calcium, it's very fast. So synchronous release is what you usually think of as you have a very large increase in calcium, and then, you know, within a couple of milliseconds or whatever it is, you get a release of a vesicle. The other pathway is asynchronous release, and it's motivated from, you know, in calyx of hell, but also in hippocampus by data, for example, from Chuck, showing that if you just plot the release as a function of time after a spike, you actually get, you know, a very rapid events, but then you get a sort of long tail that there's still a continued non-measurable probability of release that goes out to, let's say, a couple hundred milliseconds after the initial spike. So this period here, this integrated limited possibility of having vesicles that are released long on the time, on the, who is the one who said that, you know, 100 milliseconds is really long? So this is really long time scale release, 100 milliseconds or 200 milliseconds later, and that's called asynchronous release. And in the model by Sudhoff, that actually corresponds to different states of the release machinery, as opposed to somehow, you know, I don't know, different locations on the membrane, or, you know, so that's attributed to molecular, to different molecular conformations or not. And, you know, and you can read about why they did that and what the experimental evidence was that led them to this way of doing this. This is not universally agreed upon, for example. I think Nair's group does not, would not agree with this diagram. Yes?
Is this to be read that so from left to right you bind more calcium?
Left to right you bind more calcium, and you also bind more calcium going this way, but into different binding. So to bind, to go to asynchronous release, you only need two calcium bind, but in different conformations, in different states, than going this way. Okay? So asynchronous release can occur at lower calcium, much more diffuse threshold, but much more slowly, with much slower kinetics. Now, the facilitation in this model is, of course, these rates are much slower, so you actually can get stuck in some of these states as you don't recover completely from the original spike, and that's what corresponds to facilitation. It's not just that there's leftover calcium in the presynaptic zone, it's that also your sensor has not completely recovered back to its original state. So for example, that's especially true if you have a system which hasn't released on the first, so you have, you know, calcium comes in, it starts going, you know, through this Markov chain, but doesn't get to the end, just probabilistically it didn't happen to release. Then another spike comes in, and then it's much easier if you're already sort of halfway through the chain to release the second one than it was when you tried to release the first one. So you can calculate for this model the relevant, you know, probability of second release versus when you succeeded with first release, when you didn't succeed with first release, and all those things can be calculated with this type of model and compared to some existing data. I should say that, you know, just like, I mean, just one of the, it would be really nice if somewhere in someone's lifetime one could take a model for one cell type and just use it for another cell type. It probably, from evolutionary perspective, is never going to happen. So the analog of that for models is that if you take a model like this that was fit the data for calyx of held, you have to readjust it to fit the calibrator for data for the hippocampus. So we did that.
That's just
changing some of these, right? Yeah, some of these rates. Yeah, no, I'm not saying it's a big deal, but I'm saying that, you know, you have to do it, otherwise you can't get started. And I already told you we use M-cell, which, you know, does this, it's just a paid advertisement that Tom makes me put in. Okay. So I want to just give you a couple of results that you can get from this type of model, all at the level of synaptic physiology, and then I'll try to move on. Okay, so for example,
just understand, you used it, but you didn't have to use it. You could have just solved differential.
We could have just taken the same model, and instead of tracking individual calcium ions, we could have written down the diffusion equation coupled to buffers for calcium.
So,
okay. That's what I mean.
You're more stuff in there, though.
Yeah, I mean, the channels and the pumps and the buffers and all that stuff is just, you know, is in there. It would have to be in there in a PDE also. It's not like you're not saving, right? I mean, it's just a question of, you know, there's an issue in the physics community of to what extent stochasticity of diffusion, of diffusing molecules, is really important source of noise. And it's usually more discussed in the context of genetic systems where you have, like, you know, one transcription, you know, one DNA and a transcription factor's got to find it, and, you know.
I understand, but here there aren't small.
There's not small numbers. The number of calcium ions is large enough.
It's like Euler and Lagrangian method in hydrodynamics, in a sense?
Well, no, it's just random walks. They're random walks where it collides with other molecules and binds with some binding rate.
I follow the calcium ions, or solving the PDEs, fixed coordinates.
Either one is fine. Either one, and they give the same answer. So we explicitly checked that they give the same answers for anything of interest here.
Time scale for this diffusion?
What's the time scale for getting from?
To simulate.
Oh, time scale that you take in the simulation. Oh, a few microseconds or something. I don't remember. It's very small. I mean, you can check all, you can check all those and you can figure out what time scale you need, or you can solve PDEs and it's all fine. I think that's just the technical aspect of solving these this equation, which, you know, I hope we did right, but yeah, question.
Have you plugged in the role of calcium sensing dyes as buffers?
Yes, so in fact, if you notice this, so this thing says global calcium and this thing says calcium bind to some dye. So yes, you can add buffering capability that you would get if you put in some dye.
You see the influence of calcium sensing dyes?
It of course depends how much you put in, but not really. I mean, you see a little bit, but not so much in the numbers we put in. But again, it probably should be done more specifically depending on exactly what experiment you do. But you know, there's a large amount of buffering proteins already there. So it's not like you're going from no buffering to having significant buffering by adding the dye. You already have calbindin and what's the other standard one? Calcomodulin. So you already have a large buffering capability, and you know, the dye doesn't change it that much, at least for the sort of first spike, or you know, anyway, that's our. Anyway, so for example, what can you do? So one of the things which we tried to do is try to say, what would you measure in typical experiments at hippocampal synapses that would enable you to back out some of the otherwise hard to get out features of the synapse? So the particular features that might be interesting, and I'll tell you why they're interesting in a couple of seconds, would be the separation between various components. For example, the separation between the voltage-gated calcium channels bringing calcium into the cell versus where the sensors are for the vesicles. Or another thing might be how many voltage-gated calcium channels there are in a typical presynaptic region. Is it a few with a large flux through each? Is it a larger number with a smaller flux? So there are various measurements you can make which, if you use the model, can help you back out those features. So for example, I'll just give you an example of that. So if you measure the variance in the global calcium signal, so you don't have to make a local calcium signal at the sensor, you just take the entire bouton and integrate and get the measured fluorescence, so this is some measure of the fluorescence of the system, you can back out how many channels you expect. It's not surprising because, as I said, I think I've said a couple of times, that the primary source of fluctuations in this system is actually the opening and closings of the voltage-gated channels, and so measuring the fluctuations in the calcium signal, global calcium signal, gives you direct information about that, which can be averted using the model, for example. Similarly, if you look at latency, this is again not surprising, but again you can work out in detail. If you look at latency, the time scale between the time scale between the release and the separation of distance, well, you know, the calcium has got to get from one place to the other to cause the release. And so if you can measure the latency, then you can also back out something about the geometry. And imagine you've done that. Why would you care? And the answer, of course, too fast?
Well, I just don't get the numbers.
Don't get the numbers. Okay.
They seem big.
They seem 3 milliseconds? Okay, that's.
You're saying from the time that the action potential goes in and the channels open until the calcium concentration begins to jump?
To the time it gets through this this cascade of chemical steps, at least in this model, it takes 3 milliseconds.
I mean, okay, so I'm not a channel physiologist, but just looking at propagation times from cell to cell seems
3 milliseconds a little long.
Doesn't seem long. Seems very long.
Seems long to me too.
Seems a little long.
But I'm pretty sure that Tom thought about all that.
Yeah.
But is this for data from?
No, that's not data. That's not data. I mean, the idea would be that if you can measure this, you could figure out basically the parameters of the model. So the logic of the three slides is if you can measure various measurable things, would then enable you to fit the model parameters, and then you could predict what the facilitation would be for that synapse.
Room temperature numbers versus 37 degree numbers, or is this just something off topic?
Is it room temperature?
Actually, the voltage pulse versus the calcium pulse was something that was like Wade's first experiment, right? And these were numbers on the order of fractions of milliseconds. There's sort of an order of magnitude. It seems like this. Somewhere, you know,
So you're saying, but this is to release. So in other words, it's not just the calcium. No, but you're right. The delay here is the calcium propagation. We can ask how. Okay, so how long does it take calcium to propagate? 1 second, one micron. We can work that out afterwards. You know,
The standard synaptic delay is usually quoted to be a half a millisecond.
Yeah, so for some reason we have a larger number there. I have to check that.
I mean, how many parameters? You've got a bunch of time constants that are...
Well, so, yeah, I mean, so what we did is we, I mean, from practice, we tried to take the simplest modification of the Sudoff model. And essentially, the Sudoff model for the synchronous release more or less fits fine. And then we have to modify it for the asynchronous release. So in terms of latency, that actually we just use the existing model. And then there's essentially the amount of buffering, which affects the diffusion constant. Okay, there's some measurements of that, so we try to use that. And then that's it, pretty much. Then the only other thing that matters, once you have a model for the release, and once you have some diffusion constant for calcium, then it's just a question of geometry, just how far it has to go and how long it takes to go through that binding cascade.
Can you go back to that slide?
Yeah, so maybe I need to check that. Yes?
No, not too hard. Can you go back to the slide?
Yeah.
Okay,
I will check that.
I mean,
but yes.
But is the point, I mean, is there a point, is that maybe I mean, you really have to, one thing I don't understand is why to go zero distance, right, which is just saying that the calcium influx is very close to...
Well, it goes zero distance, but it still has to run through the kinetics of the channel.
Right.
So of the release mechanism.
Okay, so that 2.5 milliseconds.
You think that's a problem, that might be the right, well, but that's...
That seems off by, like, sort of order of magnitude.
No, it seems off by 2 milliseconds.
Well, you would have
factor of five. Okay.
Well.
Okay. So I will check that. So yeah. So your problem is the offset, basically. Okay.
I assume it's just
right.
The diffusion time.
Right.
Yeah.
So this is still. I mean, this has not been published. This is just work in progress. So I have to check exactly if that's.
It's got to be your calcium binding.
Yes, it's just the actual kinetic model, which okay, I'll check on that. Yes.
Where would you get those numbers from experimentally?
I mean,
has anyone?
You mean where does he have those numbers experimentally? So there's a whole series of various channel type, measurements he's made to try to fit all those numbers, and I'm not sure I have a good sense as to how believable they are. But
you get these very low affinity buffers that then bound to the membranes. So you could look at calcium.
Yeah.
Influx, right?
You go to calcium influx, but here you have to the measurements for the release is not that doesn't calcium doesn't help you. You need to then somehow make measurements of all these different states and figure out what the Hill coefficient is of the curve, so how many calcium binding sites you have and what are those coefficients, and it's in the standard tradition of detailed channel biophysics. So people have made these models and done that. Yeah, I'll check on that. That's something to be checked on, especially before we write this up. Yeah, go ahead.
So if the transfer of calcium is diffusive, shouldn't the latency go as the square of the distance?
Yes, but so it's not just it's not just a question because it also changes the shape of the calcium pulse. So you have to then convolve it. In other words, it's not just a question of the response of the system is not just calcium passing some fixed threshold somewhere else. It's that the further you go, the calcium pulse gets broader, which means that the sensor kinetics have longer times to integrate for that. So
actually, if you have any questions.
What?
Is it the diffusion equation?
Oh, reaction diffusion.
So reaction diffusion, you can get linear propagation.
Oh, no, but you're not, but you're not getting reaction, yeah, but you're not, reaction diffusion gets linear propagation when you have active creation of calcium.
Right.
We don't have that. So if you would just put a fixed threshold somewhere and say, when does calcium pass that fixed threshold as a function of distance, it would be sharper, it would be further up. But that's not what's going on here because also the way in which the sensor integrates the calcium information depends on how far away you are from the source. If you're near the source, it's a very sharp pulse. So it's harder to integrate than it is when it's sort of further away where the calcium rise is over a longer period of time. So that partially compensates for the, you know, increase the, you know, the propagation time. So at least that's my best answer. But okay, something else to think about. Okay, never going to get through this talk, but that's par for the course. That's fine.
If you got through your talk, it would be a sign of dissension.
Oh, no, I understand. That's good. Okay. So all I wanted to say was part of the reason why this is interesting is that if you can figure out these sort of structural parameters of synapse, and of course there's no statement that each synapse would be the same as any other synapse. You could easily imagine different synapses are in different have different geometries or some variation of these geometrical parameters, but these parameters then have specific implications for the balance between presynaptic depression and presynaptic facilitation. And the way it goes, essentially the basic physics is that if the distance it's got, I mean this is sort of back to the previous question, if the separation, if the distance calcium has to diffuse is large, then of course you're going to need a fairly large global calcium signal to make the concentration, you know, 10 microns away or a few microns away high enough. That's going to then take longer to decay, and this is going to give you a fairly significant facilitation compared to a sort of tight coupling limit where things are right next to each other, where you get a very, very large increase but is very, very short-lived in time because the pumps are then more efficient in getting it out, and that would give you very little facilitation, and in fact you'd get depletion would dominate. So if you look at these curves, this may not be the best way to represent this information, but if you look at this curve, this is now probability of release on the first spike versus probability of release on the second spike, and I think the separation is 20 milliseconds, but I have to, then depending on this parameter, so the numbers up here correspond, let's say 400 nanometers, that corresponds to large separations having this more broad calcium signal versus the tight coupling limit, you're sort of in this regime when you actually get synaptic depression. So the prediction of how facilitation of depression works would, you know, can be sort of backed out once you know what you expect from terms of the basic synaptic model. So that was the logic of this type of work. And one more piece about that, and you also can include, and I don't, you know, don't really want to talk because this is not even, you know, this is work that just we did once and now needs to be redone, but you actually can get enhanced facilitation if you also put in these positive amplification, the calcium store, calcium-induced calcium release. So that can give you, so if you look at the maximum value of the paired pulse facilitation ratio just for two pulses, then with no stores, the sort of maximum value up here is sort of two or so, and down here in this regime where the geometry favors facilitation, if you have calcium stores, you can actually get larger facilitation ratios. Okay.
What do you mean by that statement with the geometry facilitates?
Well, so that was the previous statement, that if the distances are large, then you need a relatively large calcium signal to excite the sensor, and that and then you have much more residual calcium, much more, it takes much longer to pump it out, and so you get an extra, you get more facilitation.
Do you envision this? Okay.
That's what I mean by, so in other words, that thing is, you know, there's two separate factors, whether or not you have localized ER near this region that enables you to do amplification is separate, but interacts with the issue of what type, you know, what are the other geometries, so sort of a multi-parameter space.
Well, I don't really know this. Electron microscopy tell you about ER and synapses?
That's a very good question, because we were discussing that the other day and we didn't know the answer. And this, do you?
I don't think you see a lot of ER.
No.
In synapses. Mitochondria.
Mitochondria is a different issue, but.
Okay, that's one thing.
My understanding was that you sometimes see it, but quite often don't.
And is the amount of stuff, mitochondria, other stuff, by chance, so dense that it actually impedes the fusion of ions, or no, or just cuts the volume down?
Well, if you as in always in these cases, if you start really being serious about it, mitochondria can act as a calcium buffer. Right?
Yeah.
Right? So mitochondria can certainly, if there are significant mitochondria there, it can certainly affect the calcium dynamics and will reduce the, and will basically soak up and buffer calcium.
Okay.
in addition to any things like calbindin that you normally think of as calcium buffers, mitochondria can also certainly do that.
Okay, but they're not causing any sort of...
They're not causing this amplification.
But they're also not causing... But they're also not so packed that it's sort of changing the geometry of diffusion. Because you sort of set up this... set up this realistic figure model, and then you...
Well, it's not... I mean...
An empty box, so...
Well...
To pack it with marbles or something?
So calcium is pretty small. If you start asking about the fusion of large proteins in the box, you probably should worry more. My guess is that, you know, tortuosity effects, you know, how, you know, can you really get from here to here, or do you have to go there? For a calcium ion is probably small compared to buffering effects, but that's just a guess. I don't know.
I said this in the beginning, but how big are active zones?
Across this way?
Micron.
So you're getting a mixture of all of these effects in a single active.
Yes.
So you're mixing between the direct, fast, and the slow.
Yeah, we're talking about within. Yes. So within a So if it's you know 20 nanometers, if there's some macromolecular complex where things are really at the same place, you get a different answer than if they're just spread by a typical 1 micron distance. That's one of the messages. Okay, I'll skip this. This is just about time scales. So, okay. Now, just five, because there were a couple of things about astrocytes, and since Suhita did some work on this, I figured I would mention it. If one has a model of this kind, or even, you know, in this case, even if one has a model of slightly less complexity than this, one can ask additional questions about, for example, you know, the somewhat controversial issue of to what extent astrocytes modulate presynaptic release. So, for example, there's a paper from 1998 by Kang and Nedergaard showing, or at least arguing, because they don't quite show it directly, arguing that for inhibitory synapses onto CA1, you actually get a large amount of facilitation due to having spikes that then activate in the sense that create sort of calcium high points in the neighboring astrocytes that then feed back onto the presynaptic zone. And so you can try to do a sanity check for models like that, in the sense that you can make a model where astrocytes essentially respond to spikes, for example, by detecting glutamate, and astrocytes then have their own calcium dynamics, and the most, you know, the most complex or the least understood part of such a model would be how does then the astrocyte feed back into release. And one of the ways it could do it is that it can release, again, glutamate, which is detected by metabotropic glutamate receptors on the presynaptic zone. And that would have an effect of increasing the local calcium concentration in the presynaptic zone. So you can use models of this kind to ask the question, at least, of what are possible mechanisms whereby other factors, in this case astrocytes, but in principle also, you know, other metabotropic receptors on the presynaptic zone that couple to the calcium system can change the release properties. So that can be done within this model, and I won't tell you much more about that.
Right, but what's the null hypothesis? That glutamate just leaves the cleft and activates
The null hypothesis.
Receptors on the presynaptic terminal?
So the null hypothesis is that the astrocyte has nothing to do with presynaptic plasticity, right? In other words, it's just there to soak up, to do whatever it does, for example, to soak up glutamate.
But in this hypothesis, yes. You're saying the astrocyte picks up glutamate and yes. Then releases glutamate. So in principle, yes. It can act as an amplifier. So the null hypothesis...
Well, but it's actually not right. So, go ahead.
Well, I mean, the null hypothesis that enough glutamate gets outside the cleft to get sort of self-activation.
So the hypothesis is...
How do I falsify... You're going to do a calculation, so how do we falsify this calculation?
So you can, for example, if you believe that any given amount of presynaptic plasticity, for example, in these inhibitory neurons, if you believe that the astrocytes are playing a crucial role due to their own calcium dynamics, you can load more calcium buffers into the astrocytes and see whether you reduce the synaptic plasticity. Okay? So for example, I'll show you just the data that was taken in this paper by Kang and Nedergaard. So for example, this is what they actually did. They didn't do that. They did the sort of opposite. This is then just synaptic release, basically spontaneous events, and they stimulated the astrocyte neighboring to the synapse. This is an inhibitory synapse onto a CA1 pyramidal cell, and they showed that they could increase essentially the the noise level, the sort of spontaneous release, no action potentials here, spontaneous release by stimulating the astrocyte neighboring to the synapse.
They used caged calcium, which...
Yeah. They stimulated the astrocyte, not caged calcium in the presynapse, in the astrocyte.
But it was predicated on that caged calcium only entering the astrocyte. So... Not everybody believes this.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure. There's a whole debate about whether astrocytes release glutamate by vesicle release. One can have a whole long argument about that, which I was trying to not go into because, I wouldn't know how to fairly represent either side of that argument. But the flavor of this paper, if you believe this paper, is that because they can couple to metabotropic glutamate receptors on the presynaptic side, astrocytes can change the presynaptic release profiles. And they tried to show that based on a couple of different types of experiments. One was just directly measuring the synaptic noise by stimulating the astrocyte. The other was showing that the facilitation could be eliminated by various pharmacological treatments that would be argued to just represent effect on the astrocyte. Though that was much less direct. That was very, inferential, or whatever the word is. This is direct, but then you can say, do they really just stimulate the astrocyte? Okay. And I'm sure lots of, and this is much more controversial than many other things that, okay. So I don't want to talk about that. I want to spend a little bit of time going to the next, so let's see, okay. So I don't know how much I want to really talk about this, but I want to at least give you the flavor of what we're trying to do because, it's perfectly okay to do synaptic physiology and compare to data on synapses, but you can then ask another question, which is, what functions of neurons or neural networks might depend or at least, be altered in their properties based on having a more dynamical synapse. So roughly speaking, the easiest way to proceed, which is to take various standard calculations or standard ideas that people have looked at in the larger scale neural systems field and just ask what would happen if the synapse was treated more dynamically. And I said, you can do this using modifications of the Tsodox-Markham model because you really can't do this type of work if you're going to have to solve a PDE for every synapse. So we just do that. We looked at two examples of sort of that motivation. One issue has to do with neuronal gain, as in the previous talk, and one has to do with sort of calculations by dendritic trees, as in the talks last week. So, okay. And I said, you'll see what we do in the next second. We just had a whole talk that focused on neuronal gain, so I don't need to go through it again. There are lots of different mechanisms that can modulate neuronal gain. We heard about the paper of Abba. We talked about inhibition, what of shunting inhibition or conductance. And all this work, especially the work that talked about the role of fluctuations in the system, always assumed that the noise is sort of, this white noise that gets added independently. And at least in our perspective, there's a form of noise, which is not really noise. It's sort of asynchronous release, but it sort of looks like noise because it's not very closely tied to spikes, that certainly can contribute to these things, like any other noise, and has a different flavor in the sense that actually it's activity dependent, because these fluctuations are eventually arising not just by other inputs from other neurons, or not just by cosmic rays coming in and causing releases, but they're actually caused by having residual calcium that was there before, and having dynamics that are coupled to the actual spike phased releases. Is there anything interesting that happens? That's sort of the question we asked. And one thing that's sort of sort of to keep in mind here is that asynchronous release, one of the major ways in which the noise now interferes with what's going on is because they both come from the same vesicle pool. So when you have this noise, normally noise is totally independent of synaptic depression, but here the noise enhances synaptic depression because noise means you actually took one of your vesicles, released it at some time not directly coupled, and that vesicle is not available now for actual phasic release. So the noise is coupled to the system because they came from the same synaptic vesicle pool in our model. Not everybody agrees with that either, but that's what we said. Okay.
But then the noise level depends inversely on the number of available vesicles.
Yes. Yeah. So this is, yeah. So the noise level is completely dependent. Yeah,
it's all the fact you have small numbers of vesicles.
Yes. And you have this other mechanism for release that looks like noise, but it's not really noise. Well, it's noise in terms of being stochastic, but it's not. It's coupled to the dynamics of the synapse. Okay, so here we use a point-like neuron model. We actually don't even use a serious conductance-based model. We use a Morris-Lacar model, which is just a simple two-component model. And the idea is we're going to take a cell and we're going to put in synaptic input into it, and we're going to put in a model which includes both phasic release with synaptic depression and also this asynchronous release. And just a little bit more details about the model. So we're talking about a single neuron and synapses coming in. And the way we do that is we make, you know, again, exactly the best way to sort of think through this is not at all clear to me. And this is what we did. So let's assume there are 10,000 synaptic inputs to the cell. Well, we don't want to simulate 10,000 synaptic inputs, so we collapse them, sort of scale them into 100 effective Torux Markham synapses. Now, when you do that, that of course, first of all, it tells you that if you know what the typical synaptic strength in terms of a current is for one of these, then you immediately know what it is for one of these. I already told you that Sutex-Markham is sort of an averaging procedure, so this sort of makes sense. In order to do this, if you really want to check this, you can do some simulations with 10 to the 4 synaptic cells. And this assumption is sort of like saying that the original inputs are sort of coming synchronously with sort of at the 1% level. So in other words, if you assume that there's really not 10 to the 4th degrees of freedom here, there's really 100 because, you know, 100 synapses are sort of activated within some relatively short time window, you can do this averaging and sort of derive what the numbers here should be. Okay, so in this derivation, the 0.3 corresponds to a 30% release probability. And then the other thing you need to do is, if we're going to include asynchronous release, you need to go through the same exercise. You need to take the data, for example, from Chuck's old paper with Yuki Goda on how much asynchronous release there is. Of course, that's done in hippocampal culture, but that's the data we live with, so that's what we use. And that has to then also be scaled to figure out how much asynchronous release is contributing to one of our effective, you know, average synapses in this model. So that's something that has, well, either you're going to do simulations with 10 to 100,000 synapses, or you're going to have to do something like this. And we tried our best to make a way to do this in some sensible way, but, you know, don't know. And this is a paper that will appear some point this year. So just to show you what type of results you get, just want to show you one graph and then quit. So we discovered a sort of interesting phenomena, which is that I guess the easiest way is to just show you the different spike trains. So this is the output from that model neuron, and it's broken up into sort of four columns. The A and B correspond to where you have a low shunting conductance. So it's pretty easy to get the neuron to be above threshold. The neuron is firing in a regime where typically the excitation into it is above the threshold. So the neuron is acting in this sense of sort of integrating all the inputs and responding to the average level. So that's what's happening in this regime. And this regime is the opposite regime, where you have a high shunting resistance, and the neuron is acting more like this coincidence detection regime, where on average, the average amount of current coming into the system is below the threshold, and now it's looking for large fluctuations in the synaptic input to it. And so that's, and you obviously see, if nothing else, the firing rate is much lower in such a regime, because now it's really looking for specific places where the noise conspires to somehow get it above the threshold that otherwise wouldn't cross. And the interesting thing is that in these different regimes, this extra noise acts oppositely. So for example, if you just look at these pictures here, the boxes correspond to high, well, this corresponds to low or even zero asynchronous release, and the boxes correspond to high asynchronous release. And you see that in the low shunt regime, what happens is that you get an increase in output rate by adding this extra source of noise, this extra fluctuations in the system. So the gain curve goes up, and the other regime, the gain curve goes down. So you get the opposite effect, and it's just summarized in the next graph, which sort of looks like this.
Wait, can you go back a second?
Yeah, sure.
Because this sort of bears on that previous talk.
Yes.
You're in high shunt, and that's sort of the limit that of synchronous input. So that's the limit that David talked about.
That's the limit in which where his graph said you need noise to help you get above the threshold.
If noise changed the slope of the curve.
Yeah. So that was the old results just add. Okay.
Slope, I don't see the slope. I mean, I don't.
No, that. But he wasn't adding this type of noise. That's not, that's explicitly the point, is that this noise acts differently than the old, you know, than the traditional results in the field. This one acts differently because here noise comes with synaptic depression in a way that can't be disentangled. That's one way to say it.
So what is the normalization? If you have more synchronous release, you have less release on the average, the amount of input is fixed.
So the normalization is that you don't, you keep the other release fixed. So in other words, you have technically you just have this Todorov-Markov model with doing whatever it does, and then you add to it a second term corresponding to an extra possibility of release, which is stochastic. And the only interference between those two terms is that when the stochastic piece releases, it also lowers the X in the Todorov-Markov model. So you use up synaptic resources. But you don't change, you don't have a sum in terms of the amplitude. So make the amplitude here, you don't reduce that, but effectively you do, because the X for any given release becomes on average lower. Okay, so the cartoon picture of this is this graph here, that you have these gain curves and you get either multiplicative or divisive gain chain, whatever the official language is, due to this asynchronous release, depending on the regime that you're in. So for example, you might, again, going back to the previous talk, if you imagine you have other mechanisms that could modulate, you know, for example, the conductance in the system, then this gives you a way of sort of amplifying that effect, in a sense, in a way that's sort of interesting. Okay, and I already said this, an accident integrator versus a coincidence detector, and this is just trying to explain the
result. You also have a claim that you can null it out, which is also interesting.
You can null it out.
Well, I mean, there's a shot.
There's an in-between that it would be, there's in-between where it has no net effect. Yeah, we can see that. We have so you can plot this in various ways.
This is a prediction.
It's a prediction, yes. And the question is, how would one... So the part of this that we struggled with is knowing to what extent one should believe that this is a mechanism. The problem is how important asynchronous release is for adult cortical neurons or adult hippocampal neurons is not clear to me. So the results about release are from the culture experiments, might be more, so we argue that this might be more relevant, for example, in developing neurons, because there, things are less established, you might have more asynchronous release.
But isn't this important for thalamocortical inputs where you have...
If you have asynchronous release at those, and that's I don't know what the current state of evidence is for that.
So when you go to asynchronous release, what's the power spectrum look like? Is it going to a higher frequency?
The power spectrum of...
Synaptic activity. In other words, is it going... It's like the amplitude isn't going up, right? I'm imagining that it's just getting to a more power, higher frequency.
No, I think asynchronous release is more power or lower frequency.
Process with the Poisson parameter going down.
Yeah.
Over time, exponentially, but slowly.
But if you have a lot of asynchronous release, it tends to average out the input. It tends to make it less spiky. That's why it's happening. That's why in this coincidence detection regime, you're getting the depression of what's happening, because it tends to make the synaptic input smoother, because you're not just, you have a large input, but then, maybe the vesicle only releases 100 milliseconds later, and you've forgotten about that large fluctuation. So the asynchronous tends to smooth out the synaptic input. and that's either good. So, for example, the effect that David was asking about is the reason it increases the low shunt is because the way we've done the normalization is asynchronous release gives you just more mean level. Okay, because now you have an extra release channel. But then in the other regime, it smooths out fluctuations, which is why that goes down.
But also, I mean, this cartoon is not quite fair because if you go back to your previous.
So the referee made us put a cartoon in. We had all these nice technical graphs.
But for the high shot, where you need synchronous, yes. The effect was much larger than for the low shot. If you just go back to your previous curve.
Well, okay, but that's a question of parameters and things like that.
Sorry, for the high shot. I mean, it's only.
Well, it depends on a percent. I mean. I don't know. Is this change different? I mean, it looks about the same.
Between 0 and 10 hertz, it's.
No, I'm not talking about this. I'm talking about the difference between the triangle, the circle, and the box.
Yeah, there's not much difference between 0 and 10 hertz.
Oh yeah, so that's this idea of multiplicative gain control, or.
Low shunt because it's integrating it. Okay.
I mean, yeah. So we can. Anyway, I just. Okay. Last thing. Okay, so we heard all these nice about dendrites and about all the different things they might be able to do in terms of. So, what happened to my next slide? Oh, there we go. So, we also did the same type of calculation, looking at the effect of a more sophisticated synapse, again, asking the role of presynaptic plasticity for a dendritic input model. So now, the model looks much more on the neuroscience end of the physics neuroscience modeling spectrum. So now again we start out with 100 synapses, and we put them on the proximal region of the apical dendrite. So I've learned a lot more about dendritic geometry since being here, but that's what we did here. So actually a picture is probably easier. So this is the CA1 taken from some database somewhere, and the inputs were distributed in this region over here. Okay, so none up way up here, and none in this sort of basal dendrite, just here, just to do something specific. And, whoops, where am I? Going the wrong way. I'm really going the wrong way. Okay, come on. Fine, results. Model, okay. Okay. And we try taking from the literature as much as we could what were the spatial distribution of the various active conductances in the system. And in this case, we used, some modification of the Tsodox-Markram idea. In this case, we went back to the original Bertram model, which is a more detailed model of the calcium facilitation, but it has a finite number of vesicles. It does not have noise, so we don't have asynchronous release here, but we just have deterministic synapses with both presynaptic depression and presynaptic facilitation, depending on the balance of, are you using up your vesicles quickly, or are you increasing your residual calcium, depending on the spike train. And again, the other feature which we put in was this idea due to Jeff McGee, who we talked about last week, the scaling of synaptic strength to account for passive decay for the soma. So as you go further away, in general, in these CA1 proximal dendrites, it seems like the synapses sort of give you the synaptic democracy idea, that sort of all synapses contribute equally, at least in the passive case. So we put that in also. And we just took 100 synapses. We should have taken, 10 to the third or 10 to the fourth. But and you can check various things that you expect. For example, if you have some action potentials at the soma, they propagate but are reduced by the time they get to the proximal dendrites, and they don't make it up to the distal dendrites, which is what's typically expected for these CA1 pyramidal cells. So you can check all the parameterizations that you get things that are sort of reasonable. And then, what's the question here that we addressed? Well, the question had to do with the following. You have a large amount of synaptic input. We have no inhibitory input in the system, so we're just doing excitatory input. So you would expect if you have a large number of synapses coming in, sort of, we have a renormalized, 10 to the fourth, but renormalized down to 100, and you would expect, well, there's a large excitation coming in, the neuron's just gonna fire a large amount because there's no balance balancing inhibition to prevent that from happening? And the answer is, well, there is a balancing inhibition in this. It's not inhibitory input, it's synaptic depression, and also various potassium currents that hyperpolarize the cell. So the system is still able to attain a sort of, you know, balance state, or whatever that means, or we've just referred to it as, you know, a sort of variable output spiking train, even in the absence of really inhibitory input. And so the logic is, you start out by taking all these neurons coming in, you give them plus on firing, but that's then filtered by this presynaptic model, the extended Sodok-Markov model. So that converts them into a much more correlated input. That then
but is the correlated part is because you 1,000 down to 100.
That's also true, but even before that, 100, let's say just in the model, 100 come in, assume Poisson, but then you process those 100 through this presynaptic, whatever you want to call it, which has synaptic depression and things like that, which introduces correlations in the individual spike trains. For example, they can't be too close to each other because of presynaptic depression. Okay, so you're actually feeding, by the time it gets into the dendrite, you're feeding in 100 independent but not Poisson trains, correlated trains.
You cut off the high frequency parts, if you say.
Yeah, you cut off the high frequency parts, and you also do one, you know, you also have modulations on other, you know, on, yeah, basically cut off high frequency. That's one, that's okay. And you cluster, you know, and you so at some scale you have facilitation, so you have some clustering, and then you cut off the very high frequency parts. So actually, I guess you should plot what you actually do to the frequency spectrum. We didn't do that. We just have a rastergram of showing what the IP, what the EPSCs look like, and you know, so I have that, but I didn't show that. And so then you have processing by these active dendrites, and now, you know, the interesting thing about this model is that it's like an experiment in some sense, which is you have this complicated model which you've tried to put in as much as you can. You can do experiments on this. You can put spikes in. You can measure things. And you get results, and you're not even and it's not always obvious to understand what's going on in your model, because that's the disadvantage of being at the right end scale of the physics neuroscience end. If you have a physics based model, it may be totally unrealistic, but at least you understand what your model is doing. Here, I'm not sure we completely understand what our model is doing, so I can just tell you the results of experiments with the model and give you sort of what that leads us in terms of thinking. So for example, here is the coefficient of variation of the output spike train. That was what we were interested in, the range of variability. And the baseline model is sort of up here somewhere. And then you can compare that to various other possibilities. So for example, you can compare that to a purely passive model down here. So if you have no active conductances at all in the dendrite, then you really do get just, you know, things that just sum, and there's no, you know, and the firing rate is much higher. That's why it's sort of further down in this graph here. But it basically looks like a regular spike train. So somehow the active conductances in the dendrite are crucial for getting this. You can look at a point neuron case. You can take everything and collapse it down to a point neuron. You don't increase the firing rate because you still have all the active conductances, but you have a fairly regular train. So somehow the decoupling of the individual dendrites is somehow crucial for this. And in fact, then you can study all the different channels, and you can vary them one by one, and you can see what matters. And so it turns out, when you go through that sort of experiments, it seemed to us that what really is happening in this is you have this, you know, calcium-dependent potassium channel, which is responsible for sort of hyperpolarization, this AHP channel. This has a time scale, sort of hundreds of milliseconds, and this sort of, you know, is sort of compatible with the correlations in the input created by synaptic plasticity. So somehow, this system, you know, has it's not really a resonance, but somehow the synaptic plasticity creates fluctuations in the system that somehow seem able to couple to this channel variation in some way that gives rise to this variability. So each dendrite becomes a very, very specific detector of certain types of correlations in the input, and, you know, only if those correlations sort of appear, by a fluctuation, do you actually get firing of a spike in the system? And so I wish I had a better way of understanding our own results, but
I
don't.
Not the consistency again, you're just talking about this use model.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And SHP, that's the thing we asked about yesterday. That's the potassium activated.
Yeah, right, yes. The calcium activated potassium current. Okay. And so, you know, is this relevant? Well, you know, place cells can be very variable. People argue about whether those carry additional information about context or things, you know, nothing useful to say about that. Okay, I'm done, finally. Okay, this is, you know, your standard picture. Components.
You gotta change that last one to 10 angstroms.
10 angstroms? One angstrom? This is from Terry or something. This is from Terry. You don't like Terry? What?
I gotta change.
Okay, so you don't like molecules. It should be atoms one angstrom and molecules 10 angstroms?
You should put a zero after, maybe just 10, and then everybody would.
Okay.
That's H2, okay?
What?
It's a molecule.
Yeah, calcium is a molecule. Okay, yeah, fine. Okay, so this is just copied from Terry Sinowski. What? I was too lazy to make up my own figure. So you want me just to Photoshop out and change that to one? Fine, David. Okay. So the logic of what we're trying to do is to try to try to understand how the components work, you know, and what consequences they'll have. You can do that. I mean, you know, the advantage of the modern day cellular biology and cellular neurophysiology is enabling one to, you know, build better and better models based on increasing measurements at the physiology level, and that's good. And I think this is the harder part. Given all this, it would be nice to at least begin to create some classes of models that can address the question of, you know, when you're trying to ask some question about information processing or about other things going on in the neural system, which of this can we forget about, which of this is essential? And the answer probably is going to be not, you know, a sharp threshold response. It's not like going to be, oh, you never need to know about astrocytes, you always need to know about dendritic trees, you always need to know about AHP currents. That's not going to be the answer. The answer is going to be, well, in certain cases, under certain times, neurons use some particular set of their components to do various things, and you're going to need to know how those work. Other times, it's going to be much simpler, and they're going to use a simple rate code, and you can get by with much simpler models. And sort of figuring out what that real sort of analog curve looks like is probably the most interesting part of what we're trying to work on in years to come. Okay, thanks. Yes.
So in the beginning of your talk, you talked about modeling all of the calcium ions.
Yeah.
You said that the atomic nature of it is not important.
Yeah.
Are there situations when you expect that kind of thing would be important?
In neuroscience or generally?
Start with neuroscience.
So we claimed in a paper, so I'll go more generally because that's where I know the answer. So for example, we claimed in a paper actually using MCell and actually with Terry Sinowski that the fluctuations of some particular proteins were responsible for the accuracy in which E. coli could divide. So E. coli, this is totally not neuroscience. So E. coli divide based on some fluctuation in a system called the MIN system. The MIN proteins slosh back and forth across the cell, create a minimum in the center, and the division machinery actually locates itself at the minimum of that time-dependent sloshing wave of concentration. So that's known. And there are models that various people have written down. I think, you know, Karsten Kruse has some models. Ned Wingreen has some other models, which are all pretty similar in some general sense of what creates this sloshing back and forth. But then you can ask the question of, okay, the thing sloshes back and forth, creates a minimum. If you really take into account the fact that there are only 1,000 of these proteins in a cell, then of course that's going to fluctuate. And so the question is, so we actually did a calculation where we tracked individual molecules according to one of the reaction schemes that have been published, and tracked what is the error in which you would locate the center. And we argued that this was actually compatible with the error that the cell makes when it actually divides. So whether you believe that paper or not, I mean, that's a case where we argued that molecule fluctuations in a signaling system really was a limiting factor for what the cell was doing. Now, is there a neuroscience example of that? So, I don't really know of one, I think. I mean, it seems to me that...
About Fred's work, noise and the photoreceptor. I don't know if that fell.
So maybe that's better. You mean at the photoreceptor level is?
Is
the noise in the G protein cascade afterwards? Is that considered to be?
Yeah.
Is there a few number of molecules? And
also an example in the notes of Rompier in auditory notes, right, that people argue that the stochasticity of ion channels, there's so few of them.
So I want to distinguish between stochasticity of ion channels, because we claim stochasticity of ion channels we think is important here too. But that's not stochasticity of a sort of diffusing messenger. So everybody who does models of ion channel, not everybody, but many people who do models of ion channels in cardiac systems or in other cases certainly put in stochasticity. But then the trend has been to say, well, we have calcium, we have cyclic AMP, we have other second messenger, IP3, we have other second messenger systems, and we better make sure that we're taking into account properly the stochasticity of the of those diffusion species. And there, you're really talking usually about much larger numbers. So you're talking about tens, hundreds, thousands of those molecules that are acting as messengers. And there, my general belief is that it's probably pretty rare to find a case where the noise due to that diffusion process is critical. For example, in E. coli, another E. coli example, people looked at the fact that, for chemotaxis in E. coli, you bind to some receptors at the front, and then you have this molecule KY, which diffuses from the receptor region, which is at the front of the E. coli, to the motor, the flagellar motor region at the back of the E. coli. And so there are calculations by people like Dennis Bray, which try to take into account the stochasticity of that process, going from KY being released here, having to diffuse there. And I think my feeling is the upshot of that is that's just not a significant source of noise compared to other things going on. But that's...
I'll tell you later. I think I thought of an example.
I thought of an example. Okay, about the messenger type thing.
No, this was actually, it was a John White thing on near threshold where they had very few sodium channels that were active, and it was just the stochastic.
Yeah.
But that's again the sodium.
Yeah, so channels, I think there's clear evidence stochasticity in channels can be important.
Yeah.
But stochasticity in sort of diffusing messengers, do you have to track individual glutamate ions, for example, in the cleft? I would be really surprised if you couldn't get by with just writing down some simple equation for glutamate concentrations in the cleft, and that was good enough for error.
And can I understand that by just saying that E. coli is smaller than a synapse or smaller than a spine?
E. coli is smaller, so E. coli, now it's not much smaller than a presynapse. It's not that much smaller than one of these regions we're talking about. It's just a question of,
matter of the concentrations? Is that what sets the concentration of the calcium?
It's just a question of how many ions there are at the end of the day. And also, it's not just a question of how many ions there are, but how long the sensor integrates for. Because even if you have a few ions, if you're sensing an average concentration over a long period of time, so the fluctuations average out over time also for a diffusive process. So you need something which is ultra-sensitive to small changes in concentration that can sort of react almost instantaneously. And I don't think that's very common. And I think it would be very silly to have such a component that did that, because it would react to fluctuations that are not encoding anything useful. It's not like synaptic fluctuations that ultimately are coming from some history dependent of what the spike train was and may actually have useful information in there. Those are fluctuations just coming from the fact that ions bounce randomly over molecules on the scale of whatever scale that was supposed to be.
Nanometer.
So I think that's not, it's fluctuations that cannot be carrying anything useful in terms of information. So it's an annoyance. And so I think you probably want to, I don't think of any place where that really is the limiting annoyance.
Charge carriers in the interior of ion channels.
Okay.
Is an example, because there are only a few sodium ions going through a sodium channel at a time, or potassium ions. And not only that, but you can't say they just diffuse because they're constrained.
Oh no, they have these binding sites within the ion, but within the channel.
That is the stochasticity of ion channels.
Yeah, but that's okay.
That's not the gating stochasticity. Right. That's the charge carrier stochasticity.
Okay.
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 failure, you should have done too.